talk of a whole series of cosmology talks, which, as I understand, will go through the entire day tomorrow. And so I will, in this talk, well, basically combine one of the main themes that will probably also be discussed tomorrow, inflation and cosmic strings. And I will more precisely consider a particular deep brain inflation model that has some nice properties, but unfortunately also some bad properties. And these bad properties have to do with cosmic strings. And then I will tell you about some possible solution of that cosmic string problem, which is a little bit different from the way cosmic string problems are usually solved in these in other deep brain inflation scenarios. And yeah, that's basically what I will do. So I should mention that this work is based on some work with various other authors too. So a quick outline. So I will just give a short introduction into very brief introduction into brain world inflationary models. And I will then focus on one particular such brain inflation models. That's the so-called D3-D7 inflation model. And as I said, it has some nice properties such that its four-dimensional effective description is a hybrid D-term inflation model. But it also has this cosmic string problem, which essentially is because you, at the end of inflation, you break a local U1 gauge group to nothing. So you get these Nielsen-Olesen strings, which are sometimes also called local cosmic strings, because they are based on the breakdown of a local gauge group. Then, now this problem here, this cosmic string problem in D-term inflation, that was already known way before that was recovered as some effective description of a certain brain inflation scenario. So people thought about that already for a long time. But recently there has been a interesting suggestion how to generalize the standard D-term inflation model just at the field theory level so that the cosmic string problem could be solved very easily. And basic idea is that you essentially double the Higgs content. So that gives you an additional global SU2 group, and then you have a slightly different symmetry breaking pattern here. And the result is that your cosmic strings, which in principle could still be there, are of a certain peculiar type. They are so-called semi-local cosmic strings, semi-local because the global and the local symmetry here. And these peculiar properties of these semi-local strings are such that they do not pose any problems for the CMB predictions of your D-term inflation model. So this was just field theory here, and then I will briefly say how one could perhaps implement that in this D37 system, and then I will draw some conclusions. So a short introduction, which we've heard many times probably already. So in view of this increasing observational evidence for an inflationary period in the early universe, you would of course also like to somehow implement that in string theory. And even though there are probably different possibilities, a very popular approach to this problem is, or has been in the past couple of years, that you identify the inflaton with one of these abundant scalar fields you have in string theory, these moduli fields. So you just imagine it's one of these moduli. And in principle, there are two types of moduli that have been considered in this context. You could think, well, maybe the inflaton is a closed string modulus, such as the volume modulus even, and that has been recently entertained by a group of authors in these so-called racetrack inflation model. And so this might be a possibility, but it was clear also in that paper that you really need some fine-tuning. So most work on inflation based on moduli actually use open string moduli. And this was originally because it was thought or hoped that open string moduli, at least some of them, might have naturally flat directions in the potential. And the kind of moduli people were focusing on were brain, were moduli that describe the positions or orientations from brains, or brain systems. And this whole thing goes under the name brain inflation. And the most intuitive and minimalistic setup to realize such a brain inflation model is probably when you just take a space-time filling movable D3 brain in then correspondingly type 2B string theory. And here there were two popular models that tried to realize this idea, one probably more popular than the other. So first you could imagine that there is an anti-D3 brain and a D3 brain which breaks the symmetry. This configuration is not BPS, they attract, and during that attraction you have some slow roll inflationary phase perhaps. And there was another idea where you, instead of the anti-D3 brain, take a D7 brain. We have a certain world volume flux here on the D7 brain such that it also breaks the BPS condition, and then the D3 brain also gets attracted to the D7 brain. Well, this is the one I will focus on in this talk. And so let's take a closer look at that. Okay, so what's the basic configuration in D3 D7 brain inflation? Well, you have to have a D7 brain and a D3 brain, and you would like to consider them somehow isolated from possible other stacks or brains or whatever you might have floating around there. So you imagine these two to be somehow separate from the rest. Then, as I said, there should be some world volume flux there, which I will make more precise in a moment. And of course, you would implement this in a compactification of string. Now this, well, then this looks like this. You assume the D3 brain fills out the non-compact part of space-time as usual. Then the D7 brain also fills out the non-compact part of space-time, and in addition wraps a four cycle in the compact space. So, of course, you cannot just do that the way you want to do always. There are a lot of things you have to consider. In particular, you have to make sure that all the anomalies associated with these brains are really canceled. And a particularly well-understood example where this has been worked out in great detail is when you compactify on K3 times an orientiful of the two torus. And in that case, you have originally, in the orientiful limit, you have four orientiful seven planes. You have altogether 16 D7 brains, and these cancel the charges of the all seven planes there. And then you, depending on kind of fluxes or whatever you introduce, you might also put in some D3 brains. And now you imagine one of these 16 D7 brains and one of your D3 brains you have put in there to be somehow isolated from the other D7 brains and what the other D3 brains you might have. And so the D3 brain, as I said, wraps the non-compact part, the D7 brain two, or fills it out, I should better say. And the D7 brain then wraps the K3. So it's point-like on the torus, and the D3 brain is point-like both on the K3 and on the torus. And now when you do this, you actually leave the orientifold limit of that whole configuration. So you actually have to do some F-theory here. And this is why the authors here chose this manifold, because the F-theory description of this model is particularly well understood. Now, I said already, you have to switch on some flux on the world volume of the D7 brain. And this can be some linear combination either of the field strength of the U1 of the U1 gauge field on the D7, or it could be just the pullback of the NS2 form. The important thing is that if you want to break the BPS condition in this configuration, this internal flux here has to be such that there is a non-vanishing anti-self-dual component, where the watch star here is the K3 watch star. When you have this, or this does not vanish, then you break supersymmetry spontaneously. Okay, so this is the this is the basic setup. But let's look at this in a little more detail. So you have this D7 brain that fills out the non-compact part and wraps the K3. And you have the D3 brain, which just fills out the non-compact part. And transverse to it, you have the two torus here. And then let's take a look at the light spectrum of this configuration. So you have three types of strings in this model. There are strings that end and start on the D7 brain. 7-7 strings, they turn out to, or the lowest lying modes, they form an N=2 vector multiplet in four dimensions, and they just gauge this U1 gauge group on the V7. But when you make the K3 very large, or just larger than the string scale, this U1 here and this vector multiplet effectively decouples, and so in the following we will no longer consider that as a dynamical ingredient of the theory. Then there are strings that start and end on the D3 brain, 3-3 strings. They similarly give rise to an N=2 vector multiplet in four dimensions, and they also gauge a U1 group, but this is now, of course, the U1 on the D3. And you know, a vector multiplet in four dimensions has a complex scalar field, and that complex scalar field just parameterizes the position of the D3 brain on this two torus. And one component of that will become the inflaton. Now, this is not all. There's also strings that go from the D3 to the D7 brain and vice versa. So what do these give? Well, the lowest lying states of this, of these strings, they form an N=2 hypermultiplet. So hypermultiplets have four real scalars or two complex scalars, which are denoted by phi plus and phi minus. And they have opposite charge with respect to the D3 brain gauge group. And so this is the lower energy spectrum of that system. Now, what's the effect of this anti-self-dual flux here on the D7 brain world volume? Well, I said that already. It spontaneously breaks supersymmetry. And one way to see this is when you calculate the mode expansion of these strings here, particularly of the 3-7 strings, you find that there is a shift in the mass here which is proportional to a monotonic function of this non-self-dual flux. So if F minus is not equal to zero, you will have a mass splitting between the two scalars of the hypermultiplet, and the fermion of the hypermultiplet will stay untouched. That will just keep its usual mass, which is proportional to the distance of the two brains here. And you see, you recognize this, the super trace of the mass matrix is zero, so it's a clear sign of spontaneously broken symmetry. Now, this is an important point, because when you look at this formula here, then you see that when d, the distance between the two brains, is very large, then this flux contribution here doesn't matter, all the mass squares are positive. However, when d becomes small enough so that it's overcompensated by this term here, then one of the two scalars becomes tachyonic. Okay, so you can figure that out, what the critical distance is. At that distance, when the brains are very close, one of these two scalars becomes tachyonic. So this then, well, this is then reflected in the scalar potential. And here we see a very bad picture of the scalar potential. Let's see. So S, that was the complex scalar field that parameterizes the position of the D3 brain, the inflaton. Okay? So when we are far away, that is when we are somewhere here, then the mass of this field, which could become tachyonic when we are very close, still has a positive mass square. So it's curved up here. Now, the closer you get, the smaller does this curvature here get, and then at a certain point, the critical distance, this other scalar field becomes tachyonic, so the potential curves down. The height of this whole potential here is proportional to the flux on the, this anti-self-dual flux on the K3. And classically, this well here, or this trench, is a completely flat direction. So there's no curvature in this direction, in the S direction. However, because of supersymmetry breaking, there will be one loop corrections already at the field theory level, which give rise to a logarithmic slope of this curve here along the S direction. So you actually do get a slow roll inflationary potential as you usually have that in hybrid D-term inflation. And then at this, so the field starts here, brains are far apart, they approach each other, then at a certain point when they have this critical distance, this other scalar field becomes tachyonic, and then the whole thing quickly condenses here and inflation ends. And this process here, that's called often the waterfall stage for obvious reasons. And so the whole thing is a hybrid inflation scenario, and when you work out the details, you actually find that this potential here is a Phi-Heliopoulos detour. Okay, there are now lots of interesting stories you could tell about this being a D-term model and whether there's an ADAP problem or not, and what happens when you include volume stabilization and then there's shift symmetry and blah, 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 loop corrections, all sorts of interesting things. But I won't tell you about that because Michael Hark will give a comprehensive talk about all these issues here tomorrow. And so I, of course, recommend that attend that if you want to know this. Instead, I will talk about something else. So this hybrid D-term inflation is a very well-studied inflationary model, and it has very nice properties. And unfortunately, however, it also has a very bad property, which is this already mentioned cosmic string problem. So let us briefly recall what this is. Well, very simple. This phi minus, the one that becomes tachyonic, the scalar field, and that condenses, that is charged under the U1 gauge group of the D3 brain. That's the local U1 we have in our theory here. So when it condenses, this local U1 will be broken to nothing. Okay, and this is the typical situation where you get these Nielsen-Olesen type of gauge theory strings, or local cosmic strings. And these are just very thin magnetic flux tubes that are supported by a topologically non-trivial Higgs field, which in this case is this phi minus, which winds around some phase in the field space at infinity. Now these cosmic strings, they spoil the CMB predictions, which would otherwise be successfully reproduced. The data would be reproduced by this model otherwise. And probably Henry Tai will also talk about these issues tomorrow, not necessarily in this model, but in a more general way. So cosmic strings after inflation are pretty bad. Yeah. And now you might ask, well, are there solutions to this problem? Because otherwise you would have to trash this model. Well, if you remember in D3, D3 bar inflation, there people have solved a similar problem, similar cosmic string problem, by putting the anti-D3 brain at the tip of some warped throat geometry. Now, this is very natural because the D3 brain for anti-D3 brain, it's energetically favored to sit there anyway. So you could easily put it at the tip of such a warped throat without being too unnatural, and then the D3 brain comes into this throat and inflation takes place in the throat. There will be some strong redshift for the string tension, for the cosmic string tension, I should better say, and you could make this a valid model in principle. For D3, D7, this does not really work because the D7 brain doesn't really want to live at the tip of a warped throat. Okay? So I have to think of something else. There has been a suggestion by Kalosh and Linde that if you just assume that the gauge coupling of the D3 brain is very small, like the square being 10 to the minus 10 or 10 to the minus 7, depending on what your prejudices are, then you could also make these cosmic strings sufficiently of a sufficiently low tension, and then they wouldn't do any harm to your CMB predictions. However, as these authors also recognize, this is a very unnatural value for the D3 brain gauge coupling because it's intimately related to the string coupling, and then these small values might be inconsistent with other things you actually want. So this is unnatural, maybe, and you might now ask, well, what can you do? Well, there was a proposal by these people here, by Urostia, Achukuro, and Davis last year, which just considered the ordinary field theory version of the term inflation. And they found an interesting mechanism, which is intriguingly simple. Maybe it's too simple, but it's, let me nevertheless explain how it works. They just say, well, the only thing you have to do is just double the Higgs content. Okay. So in our case, instead of one hypermultiplet here, we just assume we have two. And furthermore, you have to assume that they're connected by a global SU2 symmetry. So yes. And then your gauge group, or the your symmetry group, I should better say, is a product of a global SU2 times a local U1. And the breaking is such that it's broken to a global U1 whose generator is actually a linear combination of these two. This is precisely the signature of what is called semi-local cosmic strings. Well, this symmetry breaking can lead to them. And as I said, they are semi-local, or called semi-local, because you have global and local symmetries. Now, okay, semi-local strings, what is that? Well, first of all, there's sometimes a misunderstanding in the literature. You still have that a local U1 is broken to nothing. So you still get topologically conserved fluxes. So your theory has, or the solution space decomposes into a set of topologically distinct sectors which are characterized by conserved topologically conserved magnetic flux. So in principle, cosmic strings can still exist in this model too. So then you might ask, well, then what do we gain here? Well, the point is, even though these strings, they are still cosmic strings, they have some peculiar properties. In an ordinary Nielsen-Ollison cosmic string, the width, the thickness of the flux tube is essentially, it's not essentially, it's fixed. Okay? It's fixed by the mass of the Higgs particle in that model, or by the inverse mass. So there is no, you cannot change that. The lowest energy configuration is just a very thin flux tube. Now, in this case, you have an additional scalar field here. Or we have a lot of scalar fields, but only one of them really matters. And this leads to a, so you can think of it as if you have an additional degree of freedom in that model, and that is reflected also in the solution space. Namely, even though the magnetic flux is topologically conserved, so the total integral of the flux tube here is the magnetic flux is always the same, you can still deform that without changing the flux here by making the flux tube wider. Okay? So the total flux stays the same, but the flux tube can spread out over larger regions of space. Of course, then the magnetic field, the magnitude has to decrease in the core, but the flux tube itself can be made wider. And which of these configurations is now the energetically favored one depends on the parameters of the action. In a supersymmetric theory, these are degenerate, so you have a zero mode actually that can interpolate between thin flux tubes and thick flux tubes. So then you say, okay, well, so what? Then we have thick flux tubes and thin flux tubes. We still have them. So why should that solve the problem? Well, you have to remember that cosmic strings in a phase transition are not just born infinitely long, and they stay infinitely long forever, and they were infinitely long forever. This is not what how it works. In a phase transition, you only initially you get short string segments, and they are as long as the correlation length in your phase transition is. So after the phase transition, you first of all you get short string segments, and in this model, the thickness is not fixed. It's not favored energetically to be thin, so you will have randomly distributed thicknesses among your segments. So you might get a situation such as this one, where you have a thin segment here, and then there's a thick segment, and then a thin segment says, okay, here, I'm here, and then there's another very thick segment, then maybe, and then, so you can get this funny structure here. And when you look at the field lines, what do the field lines do, the magnetic field lines? Well, here there are very constrained, a very small tube, but then here they can diverge, they can fill a larger region of space, and then here they have to reconverge, here they go upside again. So if you just look at the flux lines, here at this point, that looks like as if there is a effective monopole, magnetic monopole at the end of the string, here, okay? And similarly here and here. So you effectively can think of such a configuration as a collection of short string segments that have some effective magnetic monopoles at the ends. And it's these monopoles, these effective monopoles, that do the job for you. Namely, when you do some numerical computer simulation, which I have not repeated here, but just illustrated. So this, what happens is you have these segments, and then the two monopoles are more likely to attract each other and let the string segment shrink instead of recombining with the monopole from a neighboring segment. So the end result is that all these two segments, or most of them, will very quickly just disappear, and you just get some radiation here and everything's gone. You might also get loops, and they also shrink. And when you look at these original simulations. So semi-local string segments disappear soon after the formation. And when you look at the details, you find that all the good properties of hybrid D-term inflation are preserved, and the cosmic string problem is no longer there. That's at least the claim by the others. Okay, so and it sounds reasonable. And the well, if you think of it as, I mean, it just means that the flux just spreads out to a very large volume, so you don't have a concentrated lump of energy anymore along a thin string. Yes, yes. But it doesn't matter. I mean, the only, well, you get, you, well, essentially what you get are, so if you see this thin string segment that corresponds to the one with the two monopoles, so if that shrinks, then the thick segment actually expands. So you would get very thick strings, which you would no longer recognize as such strings. It's just a very weak magnetic field at some places. And this is no longer dangerous for perturbations. Yeah. So it's not a modulus. It's a it's not a modulus. It's a the scalar field that condenses here has a very non-trivial potential. It's just it's a mode of a D3 D7 string. So it should not be viewed as a modulus. So it's yeah. So this seems to be okay. Now this was just in field theory in D3D7 inflation. So can you implement that also in our system here, D3D7 inflation? Well, the only way you could possibly think of how that could work is you, instead of having one D7 brain, you just take two D7 brains, put them on top of each other. And then you have two types of strings that go between the D3 and D7 brains, so you get two hypermultiplets. And also you have a SU2, which is actually a local symmetry a priori from the D7s. But if you make, again, the K3 big enough, then it's effectively a global symmetry. And even if it's slightly local, it doesn't change the conclusion. So if you want to do this, then you might effectively realize this with Tiga-Chukarov-Davis mechanism. And again, you have to do some F-theory analysis here. But there seems to be no principal obstacles, so let me conclude. Okay, so D3, D7 inflation, I view that as to me it's just an alternative inflationary model in type 2B theory, alternative to the standard D3, D3 bar inflation. Maybe there are some inconsistencies in the model which have not yet been really uncovered, but at the moment I think it's good if you have different types of models which make different predictions, perhaps, and you can rule them out from whatever theoretical considerations or maybe observation one day. So it's an alternative. It's an interesting alternative because it's a well-studied four-dimensional theory. You get Seibel-Dietrich inflation. Again, Michael Haack will tell us something about that tomorrow. Now, it has a cosmic string problem, though, which can probably be solved if you just, instead of one D7 brain, take two D7 brains, and then you get semi-local strings, and they disappear soon after the formation, even though they exist as solutions, but because there's a degeneracy, they don't really form. And it's long, thin strings don't form, and they preserve all the good properties of the D12 inflation. So this might be okay. You might actually say now, well, why do you put two D7 brains on top of each other? Isn't that also unnatural? Well, I don't necessarily think so, because if you remember this previous talk, for instance, when you have these brain world constructions of standard model type physics, you also have always some brains sitting on top of each other. So this is not any way worse than what you usually also do, so it's fine. There are some open problems, though. Of course, this is K3 times T2 over Z2. This is probably a little bit general model, not very realistic, perhaps. So you would like to make a more realistic model where you replace the manifold here by some Calabi-Yau or orientifold or whatever. And then you also have to address moduli stabilization in a more accurate way. In fact, I didn't address it at all, if you realize, probably. But again, tomorrow we'll hear more about that. Then quantum corrections and standard model physics, all these kind of things. And then you might ask, then, when you include all these ingredients, is this still a valid, consistent model? Maybe not. Maybe it is. Has to be figured out. Then you might also wonder, what's exactly the stringy description of these semi-local strings? There was some, also in type 2A picture, some of these semi-local strings could be mapped to some string configurations by Anani and Tong. Or you could ask, are there other semi-local defects which are not string-like, but more poles and so on, or whatever? And there have been also various ideas in literature whether such things exist. I mean, they seem to exist at the field theory level, but can you also get them from string theory in some way? That's a good question. Maybe I stop here because I don't have any transparencies in the work. Yes. That has not been studied at all in this model. Yeah. Well, there is the that has been studied by in the field theory context, at least, for hybrid D-term inflation. This waterfall stage here. It has been studied by Andre Linde and collaborators, where they found that, so actually the potential also goes up here somewhere again, at least in the field theory model. I'm not sure whether it's true in string theory. And you would assume that the field goes up and down here and oscillates for a while. But what they found is that it actually just is one short descent, and then it stays basically there. That's called tachyonic preheat.